picks up again, gusts of 70 miles an hour in the southwest and south Wales. Lots of showers to come on Saturday. A wet and windy day for most places. Fewer showers on Sunday. The wind's still strong, but probably not quite as strong as Saturday.
Deep joy. Thank you, Darren. Now, Book of the Week. The broadcaster, Sally Magnusson, continues reading Where Memories Go, her account of her mother, Mamie Baird's 8-year struggle with dementia. Today, after her husband, Magnus Magnusson's death, and her recent hip operation, Mamie's dementia is advancing, and Sally is shocked to discover her mother has forgotten something that seemed so far beyond forgetting.
The night Siggy died, you slept in his bed with his school jumper on the pillow and your face buried in the smell of him. He was on his way home from the school sports field when he darted off a bus and across a busy road. A lorry hit him. It was May 1973, just a couple of weeks before his 12th birthday. 3 days later, I was in a hospital side room with you and Dad, waiting to visit him, when a consultant tapped on the door and asked if I would wait outside. He told you there had been a sudden deterioration. Our Siggy was gone. You did your weeping in private. I only learned from you many years later that you used to sit howling on your bedroom floor with one leg flung against the door in case a child should burst in and discover you. But your hair gave you away. It seemed to turn almost instantly grey, as if the very pigmentation of your body had been shocked into dying of grief. Your eyes, too, held so much pain that for a long time I literally could not bear to look into them. But now come words I hear with a thud of horror. We're walking downstairs together a few weeks after the hip replacement. Here's Jon's room, I say. Jon had it until he moved away to university, remember? And before that, it was Siggy's. You look at me searchingly for a long minute. Now, remind me, you say pleasantly. Who's Siggy? The blow nearly winds me. The pain I feel is not just for me, or even for him, my lost little brother, but for you. You who could not bear that your firstborn son should be forgotten. You who would never tell people you had 4 children, but always that there had once been 5. What terrifying new milestone are we passing now? I should have remembered that dementia does not do milestones. It bumps along, doubles back, plunges down, gets lost in a hollow, and straightens out for a while, so that only later do we look back and notice the miles travelled. Your younger son breezes in on a visit from London. His greying curls and beard are a puzzle, although you're instantly comfortable with him, and sure you know him. You wonder vaguely if he might be your brother. So much becomes explicable once I understand that not only were the neural memory pathways of your brain being affected by then, but also those responsible for the interpretation of visual signals. Damage will have been spreading through all the different lobes that make up the cortex. The frontal lobe, responsible for insight, planning, organisation, personality and initiative. The 2 temporal lobes, where some of the most basic memory functions lie. The parietal lobes at the top and back of the crown, which integrate input from vision, touch and hearing. And the occipital lobe, responsible for the processes of vision themselves. You've been doing a series of psychiatric tests at a place they call the memory clinic, by which, of course, they mean the opposite. The psychiatrist beckons us in. A small, kindly Asian doctor, she delivers your results. A total of 46 out of 105. Severe mental impairment, it says on the record sheet. Interestingly, your scores for language are relatively high. The doctor shows me the sentence you had written on the day of the test when asked to describe how you felt. This has been an awful experience, softened beautifully by a lovely lassie called Israella, you wrote. We could tell from that she'd been a writer, says the doctor, impressed. Your other scores are pathetically low. I keep wondering what it feels like to have your brain under such attack. You help one day by saying that it's like being on a long road, getting further and further away from myself. A description I treasure as one of the most vivid insights into dementia I've heard from the inside. What we do take away from the clinic is a full diagnosis at last. You have mixed dementia, a combination of Alzheimer's disease with its busy plaques and tangles, and vascular dementia caused by reduced blood flow to the brain from a series of silent strokes, so small they often pass unnoticed. So now we know. October 2009. We've brought you to Palamos for 4 days' break in the sun, three of us to make the going easier. A holiday organised in response to your emphatic insistence that you've never been on one in your entire life. Not even photographic evidence of you and Dad beside the Great Wall of China shakes your implacable belief that you've never been anywhere. But your mobility has deteriorated in ways that have nothing to do with the hip operation. Your distress in unfamiliar places is growing. We realise as soon as we embark on it that there can never be another holiday. You like Palamos, though. Breathing in the balmy night air, you take in the dusky harbour, jagged with white yacht masts, the wide, clean promenade, bright with tapas bars and chic with strolling Catalans. My, you sigh in admiration, it's just like Aberdeen. By morning, the analogy has changed to, this is just like when we had to pay tuppence to get into the baths. A childhood memory we're doing our best to accompany you along until you follow up with, and the Icelandic ambassador came too. More startling is the declaration, your dad and I went to America, which no one had ever discovered before. Although even here it is possible to track you across two spliced memories. Yes, you and he did travel to America. And yes, he made much of the claim that his Viking ancestors had discovered it long before Christopher Columbus. But during the Palamos nights, the stories desert you. In a strange bedroom, shared with a different daughter each time, you drift without anchorage, desperately clutching for the familiar. When it's my turn, you obsess for hours about the whereabouts of Topsy, your companion of the previous night. She's in the next room, Mum. She's asleep. You'll see her in the morning. After an hour or two, I wake to find you staggering around the room, declaring you cannot find Topsy. When at last I cajole you back into the double bed we've constructed out of two twin ones, you ask, how do I get close to you? Here. Roll over here. You shuffle over until we meet on either side of the ridge and I enfold you in my arms. I shut my eyes and you stroke my arm and run your fingers gently through my hair. But alas, when I look at you in the eerie orange light cast by street lamps across the bay, the eyes fixed on me are quite, quite vacant. You're wondering who I am. When Margaret knocks at 9 a.m, you inform her straight away that a strange woman has been sharing your bed all night, intelligence she receives with a hysterical cackle. Leaving her to get you dressed, I bid you as cheery a farewell as I can summon. See you downstairs at breakfast, Mum. You notice, I hear you confiding to Margaret with an air of heavy intrigue as the door closes, that woman calls me Mum. Through the winter, and on past another spring, we carry on our strange dance. There are times when we sisters feel we're acting in a play. We're not particularly good at our parts. Off stage, we're mothers, radio producers, journalists, writers, women with no particular aptitude for nursing, no head for business, no talent for sums, and a lifetime's gratitude to have avoided running anything more complicated than the school bazaar. Now, as you become more difficult to look after and help has to be found and managed, we're called upon to take the stage as numerate account managers and shrewd employers. Feeling increasingly out of our depth, we stumble through our parts, murmuring, "How do other people manage? How will we manage?" The latest act has opened with the recruitment of paid help. Over time, we find good people with a humbling ability to do for you with a calm smile what sends the three of us swiftly to the wine bottle. As another autumn approaches, the pattern of your life continues its roller coaster course. In bed, I lie awake, wondering how long we can manage this. Can it really be right to keep you at home as your disease advances into the later stages, when the three of us feel so incompetent and so terribly heartbroken so much of the time? "Do you realise what you girls have done with your mother?" my husband says to comfort me. "You've kept her part of the family and anchored to her children and grandchildren. You've kept her tethered to reality, even if the rope's lengthening." "A fine collection of metaphors," I tell him. "I'm serious," he says. "Any other way, and we'd have lost her a long time ago." I almost do lose you in the bath. I'm busy trying to heave you over the side when I realise you've not an iota of power in your legs. Just as I'm wondering how mere skin and bones can possibly be this difficult to support, your head suddenly drops to one side and you're sagging in my arms, breathing oddly. Moments later, you've stopped breathing altogether. I know, no doubt about it, that I have killed you. The bath was too hot. I've raised you too fast. I ease your floppy body onto the bathroom floor. You lie there, white and still. I gaze down at you, trying feverishly to remember the recovery position, just in case you're not quite dead. "Hey," protests a small voice. "This floor's a bit hard." You open an eye. "Suppose," you say next, reviving by the second, "we make a break for that window seat." Somehow I manage to haul you across the floor and onto the seat. You look at me, grinning broadly. Incredibly, you're enjoying yourself. I should have known. You are always most yourself in the middle of an emergency. On another evening, your legs give way on the stairs up to bed. I half haul, half push you as far as the landing, where you collapse panting. "A fellow who lived out in Yoker," you remark conversationally, quoting an old limerick of yours. "Hit his wife as she slept with a poker," I oblige, "but that doesn't solve the problem of how we're going to get you into the bedroom." "I could try going backwards," you volunteer, and begin a shuffling movement on your bottom, the effort of which so knocks you out that you lie flat on the carpet, unable to move or speak for several minutes after. But your eyes, when you open them at last, are shining. Your face is pink with excitement. "Come on, Sally, we can do this last bit," you say. You leading me. How I've missed it. Later, I sit musing over how much of what you used to relish is missing from your life. Everyday drama, excitement, variety, danger, risk, goals to challenge yourself with, the chance to walk into the wind and rejoice in the whirl of snow. But how to give you what you miss? Dear goodness, I can't overheat your bath and drop you on the stairs every night.
Tomorrow, a final holiday and death amongst family as Sally Magnusson continues reading her memoir, Where Memories Go. It was abridged by Sarah Davis and produced by Justine Willett. BBC Radio 4. Now the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 today, Friday the 7th of February. There are warnings of gales in South Utsira, Fisher, German Bight, Humber, Thames, Dover, Wight, Portland, Plymouth, Biscay, Trafalgar, Fitzroy, Sole, Lundy, Fastnet, Irish Sea, Shannon, Rockall, Malin, Hebrides, Bailey and South East Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800. Complex low Fitzroy 977, expected south Norway 976 by 1800 Friday. Low Faroes 973, expected just north of southeast Iceland 970 by the same time. The area forecast for the next 24 hours, Viking north at zero. Southerly 5 to 7, backing westerly 4 or 5 later. Showers, good, occasionally poor. South Utsira, 40s, Cromarty, 4th, Tyne, Dogger. Cyclonic.